From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Manhunt, a new special forces group, is being trained at Fort Bragg. They're working with Israeli commandos in assassination and other tactics. One of the key planners is Lieutenant General William Boykin, who declared that Bush was not elected but appointed by God. We'll talk with the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Seymour Hersh, who exposed My Lai. We'll look at comparisons to this new assassination team in Iraq and the Phoenix Project of Vietnam. Howard Dean today is being endorsed by Al Gore. 22 years ago today, Mumia Abu-Jamal was arrested for the fatal shooting of Philadelphia police officer Daniel Faulkner. Mumia Abu-Jamal was also gravely wounded. And this is the eve of critical round of trade talks between the United States and five Central American countries. We'll talk with Charlie Kernaghan about sweatshops.
Well, at the very moment that the free trade agreements are going forward, the unions in Central America are being wiped out, destroyed, fired, blacklisted. The workers are going backwards.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Former Vice President Al Gore is announcing today his endorsement of former Vermont Governor Howard Dean for president in a move that surprised many campaign observers. Gore ran for president in 2000, won the popular vote. He'll make the announcement in Harlem alongside Dean, who's already seen as the front runner in the campaign. For Dean, the endorsement gives him the backing of one of the best-known establishment Democrats. Gore's decision is being viewed as a major blow to Connecticut Senator Joseph Lieberman, who ran as Gore's presidential running mate in 2000. Tonight, Dean will join the other Democratic candidates for a debate in New Hampshire, where the first primary takes place on January 27th. We'll have more on presidential politics later in the program. In Afghanistan, the U.S. military has launched its largest offensive against Taliban and al-Qaeda since the so-called fall of the Taliban nearly 2 years ago. 2,000 U.S. troops have entered southern and eastern Afghanistan in the operation. On Capitol Hill, the House voted 242 to 176 to approve a $375 billion spending bill that'll cut off overtime pay for up to 8 million workers, create a school voucher program in Washington, D.C., and lower the number of days the FBI can hold gun purchase records from 90 to 1. The bill will also increase the national TV ownership cap for networks in a move that significantly aids Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation, which owns Fox Network, and Viacom, which owns CBS Network. If the cap wasn't raised from 35 to 39%, both networks would have been forced to sell off a number of stations. U.S. News and World Report says that Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz may leave the Pentagon as early as February. According to the magazine, Deputy White House National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley, NASA Chief Sean O'Keefe are two names that have been discussed as possible replacements. The Pentagon is reportedly seeking a strong manager who can repair relations with the military. 41 U.S. troops have been injured in northern Iraq after a car bomb exploded outside a military base. Newsweek's reporting that the families of troops killed in Iraq are upset with President Bush over the impersonal type of sympathy cards sent by the White House with the fallen soldiers' names mentioned in the generic text. Maggie Caldwell, whose husband Todd died in Iraq, said, quote, "something a little more personal would have been nice." Newsweek notes that Bush is known for personally writing notes to friends and financial backers. The United Nations General Assembly voted 90-8 to ask the International Court of Justice to determine the legality of the massive wall Israel is building through the West Bank. 74 nations abstained. In South Dakota, Republican Congressmember William Janklow has announced he's resigning from the House after he was found guilty of manslaughter Monday for a fatal car crash. He faces up to 11 years in prison. On the eve of a visit from Chinese Prime Minister Wen Jiabao in Washington, the White House Monday warned Taiwan not to take any steps toward independence and not to hold a referendum next year that bolsters the independence movement. The New York Times described the warning to Taiwan as unusually blunt. In Moscow, five people have died after a suspected suicide bombing near Red Square. The Los Angeles Times reports that long-term unemployment reached a 20-year high in November. 2 million Americans have now been unemployed for 6 months or more. The city of New York has agreed to pay the Reverend Al Sharpton $200,000 to settle a 12-year-old lawsuit. Sharpton sued the city after he was stabbed at a rally to protest the killing of an African-American teenager. Sharpton sued, saying the city failed to protect him. And the Associated Press is reporting that the National Rifle Association is looking to buy a television or radio station and claim it as a news organization in an attempt to exempt it from campaign finance laws. The NRA's executive vice president, Wayne LaPierre, said, quote, "We're looking at bringing a court case that we're as legitimate a media outlet as Disney or Viacom or Time Warner. Why should they have an exclusive right to relay information to the public? And why should not NRA be considered as legitimate a news source as they are?" Rahim Alhaj here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today, we look at manhunts. Seymour Hersh, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, has a piece in this week's New Yorker that starts, "The Bush administration has authorized a major escalation of the special forces' covert war in Iraq. In interviews over the past month, American officials and former officials said the main target was a hardcore group of Baathists who are believed to be behind much of the underground insurgency against the soldiers of the United States and its allies. New Special Forces Group, designated Task Force 121, has been assembled from Army Delta Force members, Navy SEALs, and CIA paramilitary operatives, with many additional personnel ordered to report by January. Its highest priority is the neutralization of the Baathist insurgents by capture or assassination." Later in the piece, Seymour Hersh talks about how, according to American and Israeli military and intelligence officials, Israeli commandos and intelligence units have been working closely with their American counterparts at the Special Forces training base at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and in Israel to help them prepare for the operations. Israeli commandos are expected to serve as ad hoc advisors, again in secret, when full field operations begin. Seymour Hersh joins us on the line. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hello.
Certainly an explosive piece that you have here. Can you tell us exactly what you found?
Well, you mean beyond, I did, Amy, in the article, but I can repeat it for you, and I'll be glad to, which is that essentially, as you read, one solution, look, you know, we're obviously, as I quote somebody is saying in the piece, we're getting mauled. Our guys are getting waxed on the ground, and it's the old sort of story again. You know, we get hit, and we can't find out who's hitting us, and so we respond. The operation that everybody was critical of, everybody, including those who support the war and very supportive of this administration, is what they call Iron Hammer. This is the current American, you know, get tough policy of bombings and destroying homes and collective punishment and going and making nighttime raids based on terrible intelligence and basically creating more insurgents. And everybody knows you have to do something different. And so the proposal, this is something Rumsfeld and a lot of people in the Pentagon, his fellow conservatives, have wanted to do for a long time, which is to, they use the word premeditated manhunt, a euphemism for killing people. They want to go after the guys they think are running the insurgency. And the only problem is, I know I'm anticipating a question, I know, the only problem is, you know, who are they and can we find them? Do we have the intelligence to do so?
And can you talk about how exactly they're being trained, assassination squads, and who's doing it?
Well, again, the word I used was we're getting a tutorial on how to do it from the Israelis. And I don't know what that does to the hair on the back of your neck. But anyway, essentially, we've been the Israelis have, according to Israeli officials, and I think this is correct, they've actually been in their a very tough approach to Hamas, particularly in the West Bank. They have destroyed at this point the Israelis by target bombing and assassinations. They have a special unit in Israel that dresses in Arab clothing of a military unit, and they all speak wonderful Arabic, and they pounce on people. They can find somebody and pounce on them. We don't have those kind of units. It's little small units. And so the Israelis have been training us in some of their tactics and how to do it once you know. And the problem with the Israeli approach is, as a lot of Israelis will tell you, is that they have pretty much destroyed the ability of Hamas centrally to control the terror bombing against the Israelis in Israel. But that doesn't preclude independent people from continuing to operate. So destroying the central core of communication and I guess process in Hamas still hasn't removed the threat, but it has certainly eased it somewhat. I think we're seeing that now in Israel. And so the idea is to do the same here, to get to targets and be as tough as the Israelis have been. It's not clear we can be because American people, soldiers generally are quite as trained to be quite as tough. That's one reason the special forces are going in. They're very tough. Delta SEALs, they will shoot. And they're very competent. Please don't misunderstand. They do what they're assigned to do, and they're very good at it. It's just, again, the kind of information they have. And so I think the idea here is to see what happens, to try and destroy the central communication links of the Hamas equivalent in the Ba'ath Party, as we see it anyway. The idea is that we are also going to set up small Iraqi intelligence units. We've been collecting Iraqi intelligence people from the Mukhabarat, the Civilian Intelligence Service, and from military intelligence for 8 or 9 months now, 7 months since the end of the combat war in early April. And by now, we've put together enough sophisticated former Iraqi intelligence officers, we think, to form ad hoc advisory groups that would travel with our special forces. They'll also have an Israeli advisor, I think pretty much undercover, in the country advising them, too. So that's the next step, you know, bang, bang, bang.
We're talking to Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Seymour Hersh. I'm looking at a piece in today's Guardian following up on your piece that came out yesterday in The New Yorker, where Julian Borger quotes a U.S. intelligence official, former. This is basically an assassination program. That's what's being conceptualized here. This is a hunter-killer team. He says, it's bonkers, insane. Here we are. We're already being compared to Sharon in the Arab world, and we've just confirmed it by bringing in the Israelis and setting up assassination teams, and goes on to say that the Israeli so-called consultants have not only been at Fort Bragg, but also in Iraq with U.S. troops.
Am I supposed to comment on that?
Yes,
I can't dispute that. I think I didn't write that, but I, you know, if you only because you know, the New Yorker has very appropriately, you know, you need more than one source for certain things, but certainly that's in the air. It depends how you define consultants, but the best, the basic line is obviously, if anything, I know this is everybody's going to lose their breakfast, but I'm probably inside the facts. Do you know what I mean? I'm within what the reality is. It's probably a little more acute. There's probably been more cooperation, and particularly within terms of prisoners. But, you know, it just the bottom line is Donald Rumsfeld has wanted since 9/11, more than 2 years ago, to get this manhunt. He called it manhunts with the plural. He's wanted to get manhunts going. He's wanted to be able to the Pentagon has assembled a list of what they call high-value targets, HVT, and they're also known as time-sensitive targets, TST. They have all these acronyms and letters. And they tried. Last year, we wrote in the New Yorker, I wrote a piece about an attack on somebody in Yemen, a former al-Qaeda person in Yemen. Other people had written about it, but the point I made in the story I wrote was that it was the first manhunt, and there were a lot of questions about what happened. You know, there were two previous attempts that they were firing from an unmanned airplane, known as a Predator, a Hellfire missile. And twice the missile had been targeted at other cars before they finally got the guys they got. And both those cars, they were waved off at the last minute in one case because they were just full of innocent Bedouins. The intelligence wasn't good. They finally got their man. When they got him, five other people were with him. And so one of them was an American citizen, presumed to be bad guys, but they weren't in the they weren't on the HVT, high-value target list. So there was a lot of questions. And, you know, the military, the American military is a very, very cautious bureaucracy. And there were a lot of guys inside that don't like the idea of being hunter-killer teams. That's not what the military does. Even in Delta and the SEAL teams, they're soldiers, and they fight wars. And they don't do targeted assassinations. And Rumsfeld, to get his way, he couldn't get his way last year. He's basically changed. I know I wrote a little bit about this in the New Yorker. He's changed a lot of the personnel. He's gotten rid of people that fought him, and this is his prerogative. And he's put in the Army positions of command people who are much more supportive of what he and some of his aides want to do, that is work with the Israelis and others to begin killing people. And so this is his show. I'm sure the president, yes, the president obviously approves, and Vice President Cheney, they all work very closely together. I'm not sure where the CIA is on it. And I think, these guys are in a real dilemma. You know, they're not winning. They can't win the war militarily. And from George Bush's point of view, they can't lose the war politically. So the answer in the short run seems to be to escalate. And they're going to escalate with targeted bombing and targeted killings. And if that doesn't work, I don't know what else they'll do.
Well, one of the things we know they're doing is that they're wrapping towns in barbed wire.
Yeah, I saw that story. Report. You know, that story actually in the Times, just to show you how funny the newspaper world is, that story was reported by everybody 6 weeks ago. That happened then. I'm glad the Times caught up to it, but it was reported 6 weeks ago. That happened in October, November. And it's been, you know, and I will also tell you what's going on is a lot of collective punishment in the field. In other words, we're going to villages where we're, you know, considered to be hotspots of insurgency and saying to the people there, tell us in advance of what's going to happen or else. And when something else, another landmine goes off or something, we're destroying irrigation devices, fields, sometimes houses, bulldozering. Using bulldozers. It's collective punishments going on now. That'll be the next story. That's been going on for months.
Hmm. You quote a Pentagon advisor saying knocking off two regimes allows us to do extraordinary things.
You bet.
You then go into the personnel who are involved with this, the rise and fall of different people. You talk about Rumsfeld's rising star in the Pentagon. Is it pronounced Stephen Cambone?
Yes.
And you also talk about William Boykin of Somalia fame.
They call him Jerry Boykin. Everybody calls him by that name. Who's a total, you know, warrior. He ran the Delta Force. He was he's been a black operator, black special operations guy. He was in Mogadishu. He was involved in the hunt for Pablo Escobar, the Colombian drug lord. Very controversial stuff I write about. And he's the fellow that the L.A. Times, Bill Arkin, a journalist for the L.A. Times, about 6 weeks ago. Published a long account based on videotapes of of General Boykin's speeches, or I guess Sunday morning sermons to born-again religious groups, or even churches, I guess, in the Ozarks in southern Florida, where he would talk about, compare Islam to Satan, and talk about how this is sort of a crusader sort of religious war. Quite unbelievable talk, and normally anybody, he did that in uniform, he was then a two-star general, and head of the Special Forces Command at Fort Bragg, and normally he'd be done. Instead, what happened is he had a meeting with Rumsfeld, and they got along very well. I quote somebody saying, like two old warriors. And he's now been in the chain of command. You know, the Pentagon will deny that he's specifically involved, but he's certainly deeply involved. He's Cambone's chief aide. Cambone is a new tough guy that's been Rummy's, gotten to be closer to Rummy, I think, than anybody right now, even Wolfowitz. A very conservative out of Claremont College, which some of you might know, the Claremont Review of Books, a very, very sort of neoconservative school. He's certainly very bright. He was a guy who 5 years ago was talking about the need to go to war with China, and now he's been the leader in the idea of manhunts. He's been trying to do stuff on manhunts for Rummy, even before he got into his job. And so he's very much on the team, and Boykin's very much on the team, and I don't know whether Cambone shares his view of this is a war against Satan, but, you know, the horrible prospect of what's going to happen, because a lot of the people I talk with, as I say, true blue Republicans, true blue military guys, true blue very big supporters, they hope everything works, but they all say the same thing. It's not going to work. It's very hard to get the intelligence. You can't really trust what we're going to get from the Iraqis. One guy said it, made a wonderful line. He said one of the particular officials, Iraqi former military intelligence, Mukhabarat guys, I mean, these were the torturers for Saddam, and they're now working for us. One of them, he said, has made an agreement with the United States, and he'll carry out the agreement, he said, to the letter, but not to the spirit. A CIA guy told me that, whatever that means. And so the next step is, and what everybody worried about, and this came up, I'd say, 6 or 7 times, in a couple of dozen interviews, was Phoenix. In the late 1960s, the American CIA, working with various sort of groups, Montagnards and Laotian groups, and et cetera, mercenary groups in Vietnam, began the targeted assassination of what was said to be Viet Cong and Vietnamese nationalists, Vietnamese communists and Vietnamese nationalist opposition. And in a four-year period, 40,000 of those people, later defined as enemy civilians, were killed by South Vietnamese count, and the American count was over 20,000 in that year. And it turned out many of the operation got totally out of control. South Vietnamese officials were playing cards and losing money and turning guys in that they owed money to us for assassination. I'm not exaggerating. It was that bad, way out of control. And that was the worry now. We're going to have another disastrous operation. And don't forget, Phoenix didn't win the war for us. We didn't win that war. So that's the other worry. And then once you're done with this and it doesn't work, what do you do? I don't know.
Well, Seymour Hersh, we have to break for a minute. But when we come back, I want to ask you about how Iran fits into this as well. We're talking to Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Seymour Hersh. His latest piece in The New Yorker is called Manhunt in Iraq. And we were also just talking about one of the seminal people in this is Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin, who was quoted last June telling a congregation in Oregon, quote, "Satan wants to destroy this nation. He wants to destroy us as a nation, and he wants to destroy us as a Christian army. He praised President Bush as a man who prays in the Oval Office and declared Bush was not elected president, but appointed by God. The Muslim world hates America, he said, because we are a nation of believers," quoting from the article that Seymour Hersh quotes Boykin in The New Yorker. We'll be back with him in a minute.
offered to come back.
Painted Black, Rolling Stones, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're still with Seymour Hersh. His article in the New Yorker magazine is called Manhunt in Iraq, Washington Targeting the Insurgents as it once did in Vietnam. And that has some experts worried, among others. What about Iran?
Well, that's the big issue, because there's a lot of people that I respect very much who say that the intelligence, in their view, is sound, that Iran, there is a specific Iranian support for the Ba'ath insurgency, which on the surface seems a little over the top because, of course, Shiite Iran and the Sunni Ba'athists don't get along well. They fought a long war against each other. Iran is traditionally had some relationships with the Shiites in the south of Iraq, but certainly the Iraqis in the south, the Shiites, were more nationalistic than they were in terms of than Shiism. They supported Saddam all the way during the war. But the intelligence, there is specific intelligence. I think some does come from Israel, and a lot of people get their edge raised. But there's a lot of concern, you know, that Iran may be playing a dangerous game. After all, Iran has Afghanistan on one border and now Iraq, so they're feeling squeezed. On the other hand, there are also people who are saying, yes, Iran is keeping all options open, as anybody rationally would, that they are certainly in contact with the Ba'athists, and they certainly there's no worry in Iran about the fact that the insurgency isn't working, but the notion that they would be actively involved is in terms of supplying communication gear and weapons and bases, is way over the top. And more, as somebody said to me, it's more of the Chalabi stuff, talking about Ahmed Chalabi, whose intelligence we now know is generally conceded, provided to the Bush administration in the year or two after 9/11, played a key role in making the case for WMD, the horrible case. And so it's a very complicated issue, but I will tell you that one of the reasons we're organizing Iraqi, you saw in the papers the other day that we're organizing Iraqi teams of paramilitary, is if they do decide to do something cross-border into Iran, it'll be with Iraqis, with American backing. That's the talk right now. And it obviously needs a lot more reporting, because what it is just a dispute now in the intelligence community. But you can't rule out anything. If, you know, Iran certainly, whether it's directly, overtly helping or not, Iran certainly, and Hezbollah too, would have a tremendous interest in what's going on. The stakes are being raised dramatically in that part of the world because of our invasion of Iraq. Israelis tell me there's nothing more exciting than waking up in the morning and seeing America to the east. I mean, Israel likes us there. Many in Israel, not everybody, because many people think it's also disastrous in the long run. But there's more talk now. You see it in just the administration's comments, more talk about hostility towards Syria. There was a long piece fed by administration officials in the New York Times. I don't mean to suggest that the information was accurate as everybody knew it. Nobody was doing propaganda. But there was a story quoting administration officials as saying that David Kay, this sort of hapless fellow that's in charge of the search for WMD, I mean, why he took that job, he must be asking himself that. Anyway, Kay is what he's found is that maybe there was an arms deal for some air defense weapons, which are not outside of the UN agreements anyway, that were purchased by Iraq, or Iraq tried to purchase them from North Korea through Syria. You hear that kind of talk. So they're beginning to open up talk about Syria again, like the neoconservatives did right after the in late March and early April, when it looked like everything was going great in Iraq and they were going to keep on rolling. So you can have the dark scenario would be that we do expand our aggressiveness into regime change into Syria and perhaps into Iran, and we end up sort of back-to-back with the Israelis fighting a Middle East insurgency. I mean, that's where some of the people, if you read what they say very carefully, what they've said over the last 10 years the neoconservatives want, that's in their writing. And I'll be honest, it's in internal papers I have that I haven't published because, you know, they're what they call white papers. They're easily discounted. In other words, a lot of the thinking inside the Pentagon is done unofficially in unofficial papers, papers that aren't officially part of the system. And so the problem with those is they're so easily discountable. And they're not real documents, and that's one reason they do it that way. They call it inside the government's known as a white paper. It just doesn't exist. But in those papers, there is talk of wholesale Middle East chaos, and that's to our advantage because the next step would then be some sort of democracy. That seems to be what they think. And it does look like, despite all the troubles we're having in Iraq, that some of those elements of the policy are still being carried out. And I can also add that, talk about self-fulfilling prophecies, I don't think there's any question that some Wahhabis from Saudi Arabia, some very radical Shiites, are coming across the border from Saudi Arabia, I think more than from any other country, and are they're in terrorists and intent on doing car bombings. So we began a war against the country claiming they were terrorists when I think everybody now understands they were not. No connection between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda, no significant connection anyway, nothing that meant much. And now we've sort of set the situation in which what we initially began the war against is beginning to happen. I know that the 2 and 3 and 4-star generals, if you ask them about what's going on, everybody wants more troops. Nobody's going to say so publicly. It means end of career. But they also all say the same thing. My boys are getting killed, and my job is to defend them. So you now have a situation where what we thought we had when we went into Iraq, we may have triggered. And what do you do with that? You know, what do you do with the fact that people are coming across the border? Well, there we are. I mean, it's possibly possibly the most bungled foreign affair episode in the history of pretty much bungled stuff we've done over the last 250 years. It has always been perfect.
Well, Seymour Hersh, I want to thank you very much for being with us. His latest piece appears in this week's New Yorker. It's called Manhunt in Iraq. You're listening to Democracy Now! As we continue the program on this eve of a critical round of talks between the United States and 5 Central American countries, we're going to talk to Charlie Kernaghan. Charlie Kernaghan has long been an activist around issues of sweatshops. And tonight there will be a major protest in New York outside of Sean Combs' store. Tell us why, Charlie Kernaghan.
Well, Sean Combs has a clothing line, Sean John, very successful fashion company. In fact, one of the fastest growing. And recently in Honduras, we met with some workers who made his clothing and were shocked when they told us that to get the jobs, they had to take mandatory pregnancy tests. And if they were tested positive, they were fired. They were searched on the way in the factory to take candy away from them because they didn't want them to soil the garments if they were, you know, God forbid, bought in a Tootsie Roll. They told us they needed permission to use the bathrooms. They had toilet passes. They could use the bathroom once in the morning and once in the afternoon. They had to raise their hand like little children, get permission from the supervisor, get the toilet pass, give it to a guard at the toilet, and they were allowed to go into the toilet. They were searched before they went into the toilet because they said maybe they'll try to steal a Sean Combs T-shirt. If they spent more than 2 or 3 minutes in the bathroom, they were screamed at and pulled out and put back to the workplace. They were making $40 Sean Combs T-shirts. They were paid 15 cents for every shirt they made. They were living in abject poverty. The bathrooms had no toilet paper. The drinking water was filthy. The factory was hot. And the workers had zero rights. The supervisors would stand over the workers for a half an hour at a time, screaming and yelling at them to go faster, that they had no rights. And, of course, if they tried to organize a union, they would be fired and blacklisted. And if a union ever came into the factory, they'd close the factory down and move to China. So, in other words, it was shocking to see $40 T-shirts being made under such abusive conditions with people who were living in abject poverty.
Hmm. Just for people who don't know, Sean Combs, P. Diddy, also Puff Daddy, looking at a recent piece in Washington Post, says hip-hop mogul Sean P. Diddy Combs built his fortune with swagger and business savvy. But then he said last month, walking into the Hilton Hotel, had to answer accusations that his latest venture, the clothing line known as Sean John, relied on Honduran women paid pennies to stitch T-shirts that retail for $40 in Soho boutiques. He says he first heard of the charges while walking the red carpet at Radio Music Awards in Las Vegas on Monday night. He hopped a jet to New York, insisted he would investigate the allegations thoroughly. Combs said, "I grew up in a family of working people. I know what it's like to struggle day after day in a job to put food on the table. I want to make sure that any merchandise that has my name on it is made by workers who are treated well." Now, this is a piece from October 29th of The Washington Post. It's now a month and around 5 weeks later. Has he responded to your charges?
Well, actually, there's been some developments last night. We do have a meeting with Sean Combs this Friday. We always thought that he might do the right thing. He said the right thing, but didn't do anything. Maybe now those words will be backed up. This isn't Kathy Lee Gifford. This isn't Walmart. Sean Combs doesn't have to get down on his knees and kiss Walmart's feet, the biggest sweatshop abuser in the world. This is his company. It has his name on it. He's supposed to be a progressive person. He's supposed to, you know, have grown up in a working class family. He's supposed to understand this stuff. Sean Combs could do a lot to end sweatshops and child labor. And so we want him to clean this factory up in Honduras, not to pull out of the factory. Workers need these jobs, but get those locks off the bathrooms, end those pregnancy tests, stop the forced overtime, pay the workers correctly. And yes, the workers have a right to organize. So we intend to come out of Friday's meeting with a statement from Sean Combs that he 100% supports those workers' rights to organize. He wants their rights respected. And from there, we can build a better model around the world, because he's also producing in China, in the Philippines, in Vietnam. So, in other words, what we uncovered in Honduras is just the tip of the iceberg. Will Sean Combs do the right thing? We hope so. And he has the power, actually, to take the industry to a new level. And you know, the shirts are $40 a piece. If he raised the wages of the workers by 66% so they could climb out of misery and into poverty, which would be their goal, it would only add 10 cents to the cost to sew the garments. So instead of being paid 15 cents for every garment they sewed, they'd be paid the grand total of 25 cents for every garment they sold, which is less than just a little bit more than 0.6% of the retail price. So he's in the position. These aren't $4 shirts like Kathy Lee Gifford. These are $40 shirts. This isn't Walmart. It's his own company. He could do the right thing. And he's got the power. I mean, we were very surprised by how the story went around the world. We didn't realize, frankly, I didn't know who he was. We didn't realize how powerful a person this was or how well-known he is. He actually has the power to take the industry up a few notches, and we're going to ask him to do that. We're going to ask him to disclose the name and addresses of his factories around the world to prove he's got nothing to hide. We're going to ask that he respond seriously to worker rights violations in these factories. We don't care who monitors his factories as long as they make a monitoring report public so there's something in black and white on a piece of paper about factory conditions. So at this point, we're guardedly optimistic, but we think maybe the demonstration helped move things along a little bit.
This comes at a time of the CAFTA talks. I'm looking at Jim Loeb's piece at oneworld.net, where he talks about the Human Rights Watch report that just came out charging Salvadoran government largely ignores, in some cases even facilitates, the abuses, and urge that labor rights provisions be included in the U.S. Central American Free Trade Agreement, CAFTA. What about CAFTA and how this fits in?
Well, CAFTA is going forward. This is the final negotiations right now in Washington, D.C. This is the final negotiation. What the workers on the ground tell you in Central America, whether it's El Salvador, it's Honduras, or Nicaragua, at the very moment that the agreements are going forward, the unions are being wiped out. There's a concerted attack on the part of the maquiladora companies to wipe out the unions and make room for CAFTA. CAFTA, the only labor rights provisions that the Central America Free Trade Agreement has is that the local governments will be responsible to implement their own laws, which is exactly what they never do. As a matter of fact, we brought workers from Honduras, the United States, to talk about the Sean Combs case and to talk about Gildan and other companies. And the reaction in Honduras on the part of the Ministry of Labor and on the part of the Maquiladora Association was to call those women terrorists and traitors for having sold out their country. So in Honduras, if you try to organize, you'll be fired and blacklisted. Your wages are completely stagnant. This is really the perfect example. Honduran exports to the U.S. have boomed. Honduras is a small country, 6.7 million people. They're the third largest exporter in the world of apparel to the United States, $2.6 billion a year. They come in right behind Mexico and China. So here's this tiny country, which is the third largest exporter of apparel to the U.S., and its exports last year were up 18.5%. This is trade. It's working as it should work until you look at the workers and you see that they're still living in the same miserable hovels. Their wages are stagnant and they have no rights. And if they try to organize, they're fired.
Charlie Kernaghan, where's your protest tonight?
Well, tonight it's going to be a rally. We think it's going to be a victory rally. I actually think maybe we're going to get some more news today. So it might not be a protest. It might actually be a victory rally, and we might have someone who's going to step out in front of the anti-sweatshop movement, and that person would be a hero, like Sean Combs, if he does the right thing. So it's going to be at 41st Street and 5th Avenue, right across the street from the New York Public Library. And it's a new store that Sean Combs is about to open, and I think it's going to be a lot of fun. And I actually think this may be a turning point. This may be a victory. Might not be a protest. Actually, may be a victory rally. And it's going to be good news for the workers in Central America.
Well, we will report on what happens on Democracy Now. Thanks very much for being with us. Charlie Kernaghan, Executive Director of the National Labor Committee, your website.
It's www.nlcnet.org. There's a lot of information on this about El Salvador, Nicaragua. We're not just focusing on Honduras. We have plenty of cases to demonstrate that these governments are not implementing their own laws.
Thank you for joining us.
You
are listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
They used to tell me I was building a dream, and so I follow the mob. Where there was earth to plow or guns to bear, I was always there, right there on the job. They used to tell me I was building a dream, with peace and glory ahead. Oh, why should I be standing in line, just waiting for bread? Oh, once I built a railroad, made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, and now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower to the sun, brick and rivet and lime. Once I built a tower, and now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Oh, once in khaki suits, gee, we look...
Brother, can you spare a dime? Yip Harburg wrote the lyrics, blacklisted during the 1950s in the McCarthy era. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now! Former Vice President Al Gore is announcing today he's endorsed Howard Dean for president in a move that surprised many campaign observers. The Washington Post says Gore's move gives, quote, the insurgent candidate the kind of establishment backing his campaign has been lacking. Gore's decision is being viewed as a major blow to Connecticut Senator Joseph Lieberman, who ran as Gore's running mate in 2000. Earlier, Lieberman, appearing on the Today Show, said Gore's announcement, quote, I was caught completely off guard. Lieberman went on to say, quote, what really bothers me is that Al's supporting a candidate who's so fundamentally opposed to the basic transformation that Bill Clinton brought to this party in 1992. Tonight, Dean will join most of the Democratic candidates for a debate in New Hampshire, where the first primary takes place on January 27th. We're joined right now by Matt Taibbi, who writes for New York Press and The Nation magazine, is on the campaign trail. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Matt Taibbi. It's good to have you with us. Your thoughts on Dean, and also want to talk to you about going undercover in General Wesley Clark's campaign.
Yeah, the Dean announcement with Gore. I mean, I don't see how Lieberman could have been all that surprised by that. I mean, you know, his position on the war is so completely opposite to Gore's that you know, I can't imagine that he actually expected Gore to come out and publicly support him, especially given that he's doing so badly in the polls now. That doesn't make any sense. So I'm sure when he says that it's a surprise, he's just posturing, I imagine.
Can you talk about your experience with General Wesley Clark's campaign. And also, a lot of what you've written about Clark is new. I don't think people really understand his history the way you've described it.
Well, a lot of the stuff that I wrote about with Clark, it's actually out there. I found it, through reading old articles and some old biographies of him, but it's just not widely circulated, and it's also not discussed in the context of what he's actually saying about Iraq, which is to me what the important thing is. I mean, Clark has a history going back to when he was a student at Oxford, when he was a Rhodes Scholar. He actually took time out from his studies to give speeches around England in support of the Vietnam War effort. And this just goes hand in hand with a lot of little factoids about his biography. He voted for Nixon in 68. He was a speechwriter for Al Haig in the Supreme Headquarters of the Allied Command in Europe, which is called SHAPE. Supreme Headquarters Allied Powers Europe, SHAPE. So he worked for Haig in Europe. He was a speechwriter for Haig. He also worked in the Ford White House as a military advisor. But he's really an unrepentant supporter of the Vietnam War effort, which is interesting when you look at his position on the war in Iraq. Most people think of Clark as really an anti-war candidate, and what he does on the campaign trail, when he gives the speeches, he really does say a lot of things that would suggest that he's against the war and that we shouldn't have gone in. And he says that openly fairly often now, that it was an elective war and we shouldn't have gone, and that was a mistake. And this is really a big applause line for him on the campaign. But then he also says a lot of other things that are much less reported. It was that one press conference of his where he said this really cryptic thing. He said the legacy of the Vietnam War will be put to rest by the legacy of Iraq. And I was in a crowd of reporters, and everybody was kind of looking at each other saying, well, what does that mean? And afterwards, I went and talked to his press guy, Bill Buck. And it turns out that what he means by that is, Buck says, well, the legacy of Vietnam is that Vietnam was a war we went into without a strategy for a successful conclusion, whereas Iraq is a situation where we can go in and be successful. And I said, so success means winning the war, right? Not withdrawing or somehow other, in some other way, concluding this whole thing. And he says, oh, absolutely, success means winning. He's never made any secret about that. So I think if you look closely at what Clark is saying about Iraq, what he really believes is that it's not that different from the Bush position or any of the other candidates, really. He believes that we have to go in and somehow win this thing. And, to quote Joseph Heller, win what? What do we win? And that was my big question about Clark.
I have to say, I was shocked not when he threw his helmet in the ring, but when the media described him as an anti-war warrior. I mean, he's been a CNN consultant throughout the invasion and before, and his daily columns in the Times of London. This was a man who was definitely cheerleading for war repeatedly, and if he was against it, it was very deep, deep, deep in his heart, and he was not letting on to his viewers.
Yeah, that's another thing that I really had a hard time understanding about Clark, and I wrote a little bit about this. But if you really thought that the war was wrong, the last thing you'd want to do is get up and on national television and talk about how wonderfully this or that weapon system was battering Iraqi defenses. I can understand that he has a lot of admiration for the way our army and our weapon systems work. But if they're being used for a wrong end, it's no longer a glorious military exercise. It's wrongful killing. It's murder. It's all these things. And he didn't seem too troubled by that. So I don't know. I always thought that it was a little strange, and this there was something a little bit pathological in the way that a lot of people in the Democratic Party seem to want to leap on the bandwagon with him as an anti-war candidate.
Matt Taibbi, you've also written about President Bush's trip to Iraq. There is a lot that is coming out that doesn't make it mainly to television, and that's where most people get their news. The fact that he went at 5:30 in the morning, waking up the troops for Thanksgiving dinner, then the whole story of the turkey that is the famous picture of him. And yet, here is a turkey that was not actually served to the troops.
It was a plastic turkey.
Was it actually plastic?
Yeah, apparently it was a plastic turkey.
It was plastic?
Yeah. That was actually reported in another part of the Nation in the Daily Outrage column online. But, yeah, it was a plastic turkey, apparently. Which is even funnier. The famous shot where he's holding the big turkey, apparently that's a plastic turkey.
Can you talk a little more about this trip, as you've talked about it, stuffed on Thanksgiving in Baghdad, the Fourth Estate buys the fake?
Well, I think the thing that's really, you know, that's really funny about this whole trip is the way the media responded to a lot of high-handed tactics that the White House was using. And this is kind of an ongoing thing. It wasn't just a one-off event that happened on Thanksgiving. This has been going back for about a year now. There have been a number of reporters who've had some problems with the White House when they ask questions or write articles that the White House doesn't like. There have been some retaliation by the White House. For instance, the Washington Post last year published an article just before the famous press conference that he gave just before the war that was called Taking Liberties with the Truth, and that was a double byline by Dana Milbank and Mike Allen. And traditionally, the White House calls on the Washington Post at some point during a press conference. They sit in the front row, but in the pre-Iraq presser, Bush just looked straight past Milbank and Allen, and it was widely accepted that this was a retaliation for having written some nasty things about the Bush administration. Then, you know, there were some other reporters that had some problems. Then earlier this spring, as the White House came out and openly said that it had some concerns about the way that the press was covering the Iraq war and that it wanted to eliminate the filter between the White House and the American people by taking its case directly to the local affiliates. So it gave a series of 8 interviews to local affiliates or companies that own local television affiliates, just bypassing the major TV networks. And this was, you know, the CBS called it the public relations equivalent of a declaration of war. So there was some tension going on even before this Baghdad trip between the White House and the press corps. And so what does Bush do on Thanksgiving? He literally kidnaps a few reporters, takes them on the plane, flies into Iraq, tells them that they can't make a call to their editor or else, you know, he makes the sign of cutting his throat to the reporters in the plane. And then everybody else, he just leaves out of it and expects them to kind of give them the hagiographic coverage that everybody else is going to give. And instead of fighting back in this instance, like, for instance, the New York Times was completely left out of this whole scenario.
Matt, we have 10 seconds.
Okay. Well, instead of fighting back, they rolled over and gave him everything that he wanted, the big photo op and all that. And I just thought it was a shameful performance. So.
Well, guests concerned about future access, what we here at Democracy Now! Call the access of evil.
Right.
Well, Matt Taibbi, thanks for joining us. We hope to talk to you again on the campaign trail. Okay. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we end today's show on this 22nd anniversary of December 9th, 1981, that was the day that Mumia Abu-Jamal was arrested for the fatal shooting of Philadelphia police officer Daniel Faulkner. We're joined on the telephone by Pam Africa of Friends and Family, International Concern, Family and Friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal, and also Philadelphia lawyer Angus Love. Just a week or two ago, the Office of International Concern, Family and Friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal was broken into. Pam Africa, your thoughts on this day. Mumia Abu-Jamal, eventually convicted of the murder of Daniel Faulkner, still sits on death row.
Yes, Amy. You know, the governmental terrorism that's happening here is unbelievable. The breaking in of my office, where computers was taken and everything that they could not move and are they completely destroyed. The terrorism of what's happening with, Angus Love. On December the 13th, we're having a program and are making a call to order. Enough is enough. We have proven beyond anybody's reasonable doubt that Mumia Abu-Jamal was innocent of killing police officer Daniel Faulkner. And on December the 9th, Mumia was brutally beaten. He was shot. And the only reason why he's in jail because survived crime. We're asking people who are fed up with what's happening, the injustice to Mumia and other people to join us in Philadelphia at Benjamin Franklin High School at 1 o'clock and all for a indoor program. There's a march that's starting earlier from 10 o'clock, coming from 7th and Fairmount in Philadelphia. And, you know, Amy, you know, we really, really need more time in order to talk about the governmental conspiracy and what's happening here and dealing with Mumia's case. And all, because the breaking into my office is one thing, but the beatings, the jailings, and all, and it's even murder has happened in Mumia's case, which is not being actually, you know, told here, you know, so that people can understand the conspiracy, you know, where, you know, people are writing books and, you know, there's misinformation in the books. And Michael Moore's book is one. And we're not finished dealing with the issue of Michael Moore. And we have got to, you know, get an apology for Michael Moore and dealing with the segment that he put in his book where he said Mumia probably killed police officer Faulkner. Stated was that, you know, he was just being flipped. And but you cannot be flipped with a man's life. And today marks 22 years, and the campaign to kill Mumia is escalating, and the campaign to free Mumia is going down because of governmental terrorism. And but what we're saying, enough is enough, and it's time for everybody to rise up, stand up, and deal with the facts in the case.
Pam Africa, you mentioned the Philadelphia attorney, Angus Love. Can you say what is happening with him right now?
Right. I was listening to the radio this morning, and Angus Love, he signed a signature ad calling for a fair trial for Mumia. And he also was one of the lawyers that defended the youth from the Republican convention here in Philadelphia. But the FOP has taken up a campaign against him. He is running for Human Rights Commission and a Civil Service Commission, and they have actually taken up a campaign, you know, to stop him from getting this position based on the fact that he has signed a signature ad for Mumia and has called for a fair trial, and that he has gone out and spoken out against police brutality, you know, here in Philadelphia and across the United States.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, Pam Africa. December 13th, you'll be having a broader discussion in Philadelphia about the case. I also want to say that we did call the Fraternal Order of Police yesterday to ask for a representative to be on the program, but they did not get back to us.
Well, they wouldn't get back with you because you're balanced and all, to be fair.
On December 13th, where is the event that you are having taking
place?
It'll
be in North Philadelphia at Benjamin Franklin High School, and we got people coming in from all over. And what we're doing, we're presenting the evidence. And Mr. Arnold Beverly and all will be present. Terry Cartamora and all, who is the stenographer, who stated that she overheard Sable saying that he's going to see to it that, you know, they execute Mumia. Veronica Jones, and there'll be a whole lot of other people. Aaron Patterson, and all from Chicago, who was recently released by Governor Ryan. He's coming in with Fred Hampton. Professor Dennis Brutus is bringing people in. And also the great-great-great-granddaughter of Frederick Douglass is traveling with a contingent coming in from Washington. So we hope to present the evidence and put a breath of air back into the movement for Mumia.
Well, Pam Africa, I want to thank you very much for being with us, speaking to us, international family and friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal. That does it for the show. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Purvey Sharma, Jeremy Scahill. Our website is democracynow.org. If you'd like to get a copy of the show, 1-800-881-2359. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Guns to bear, I was always there.